Chapter 12. To do justice to Marilyn Monroe, John F. Kennedy, and Dorothy Kilgallen, it is necessary to examine carefully how and by whom the 35th President of the United States was slain in November 1963. Why? Because, as noted, the road to the truth about why and how Marilyn Monroe and Dorothy Kilgallen died intersects with the assassination of JFK, and the common denominator is the actions of Bobby Kennedy toward underworld figures he hated after Joseph Kennedy forced JFK to appoint RFK Attorney General after JFK took office. To be certain, if Joe had not double-crossed those who helped JFK win the White House, RFK would never have been able to seize power so frantically as to cause his brother's death, and it appears likely he never would have been in a position to become romantically involved with a movie star such as Marilyn. This, in turn, would have precluded Kilgallen's involvement in an investigation of JFK's assassination. In effect, all three, as will be shown, would, without question, have lived longer lives and enjoyed the fruits of those lives for many years to come. With this in mind, time must be taken for a close examination of the salient facts based on primary sources, not speculation, as to what happened on that dreadful, fateful day in Dallas when JFK was cut down in the prime of his life, amounting to cold-blooded murder. By doing so, clarity appears as to why, how, and by whom both Marilyn and her friend Dorothy indeed became collateral damage, in effect victims of a father and son who abused power to the highest level possible. The basic facts regarding the shooting of John F. Kennedy are well known, as is the road he took to the presidency. In 1960, by the slimmest of margins, 112,827 votes out of 68 million plus, 303 electoral votes to 219, JFK defeated Vice President Richard Nixon to become president. From the shadows, Joseph P. Kennedy had masterminded the election of his son. Some critics of the election alleged that he manipulated the result, while others used stronger descriptors such as fixed and stole. But despite cries of protest from the Republicans, no investigation of the election occurred. On Inauguration Day, January 20, 1961, Joe Kennedy beamed with pride. His dream of seeing a son become president had been fulfilled. By the fall of 1963, JFK was fully immersed in his re-election campaign, managed once again by brother Bobby. The campaign included a trip to Texas, where Vice President Lyndon Johnson wondered whether the president might cut him from the ticket. Consequently, to soothe Johnson's worried soul, Dallas was included on the Texas itinerary. The visit was well planned and included a detailed motorcade route from Love Field to the downtown Trade Mart. This final route, released to the public, was altered from the original plan through part of a Dallas suburb, past the downtown area along Main Street, and then on to the Trade Mart via Stemmons Freeway. The route chosen presented one serious flaw. Ending up at the Mart required leaving Main Street by turning left on Elm Street. Oddly, or perhaps it wasn't so odd, no one seemed concerned that this route would take the motorcade through Dealey Plaza past the Texas School Book Depository building on the northwest corner of Houston and Elm Streets. Who finally approved an open-top limousine, a 1961 Lincoln, for the president's trip to the Mart has always been a matter of conjecture. But needless to say, the route chosen was a death trap in the waiting, since the president would be a sitting duck for anyone with evil intentions due to the close quarters in and around the plaza. Few knew the history of Dealey Plaza before JFK appeared on that fateful day of November 22, 1963. In their book, Dallas 1963, authors Bill Minutaglio and Stephen L. Davis provide startling facts about both the plaza and how Dallas had blood on its hands prior to the president being assassinated. Regarding the plaza, the authors revealed that Ted Dealey, whose father George had founded the Dallas Morning News in 1885, steered the newspaper to the far right when he took charge. At one point, they quote young Dealey describing the paper as an ultra-conservative journal opposed to social progress, the United Nations, the Democratic Party, federal aid, welfare, and virtually everything except the Dallas Zoo. In October 1961, Dealey was one of 18 newspaper publishers invited to the White House to lunch with JFK. Disgusted with how the others were holding the president in awe, the arch-conservative butted into JFK's speech, asking, "Isn't one of the purposes of this meeting to get an expression of grassroots thinking in Texas?" After the president nodded in agreement, Dealey proceeded to shock the room full of publishers and JFK by charging that he and his administration were weak sisters and that "we need a man on horseback to lead this nation, and many people from Texas and the Southwest think you are riding Caroline's tricycle. We are not morons to be led around the nose by an invested bureaucracy." Needless to say, JFK was taken aback with these accusations, and the luncheon ended on a sour note. The authors wrote that news of Dealey's face-off with Kennedy sweeps the nation. Papers across Texas chastised Dealey, but he didn't care. 2 years later, JFK would be assassinated in the very plaza named after Ted's father, George. An article Minutaglio and Davis wrote in October 2013 was headlined, "How the Morning News Helped Dallas Become the City of Hate." Until this author was contacted in May 2020 by Florida architect James Lawson, the fact remained unknown that while the open limousine was the vehicle of choice in Dallas, RFK had suggested this so JFK could be closer to the people, JFK had given a speech the night before at the Sheraton Bal Harbor Hotel in North Miami Beach, Florida, that cast the choice of the open limo in a new light. Lawson related the following surprising news. "During my very first project as a young architect at large at an architecture firm in Miami, they sent me to redo the Sheraton Bal Harbor Hotel, North Miami Beach. This was where Kennedy did a fundraising dinner event the night prior to flying to Dallas. The interesting thing that I came to know while working on the hotel renovation was the Kennedy door. The chief engineer of the hotel explained that when the Secret Service reviewed the property in 1963, they determined that the most secure location was for the president to stay in the Garden Villas, which were a separate wing on the backside of the main ballroom separate from the hotel towers. However, to get to the ballroom from those villas would require walking all the way around through a long corridor. So they requested that a door be cut into the wall of the ballroom that abutted the corridor to those garden villas, thus out one door across the hall and into the backstage of the ballroom. The hotel installed that door, then, after the president's visit, they drywalled back over it." Lawson added, "I always found this to be a curious story about how the Secret Service was so concerned about JFK walking around a corridor of a hotel that they had to install a door through a wall, but the next day let him ride in an open-top limousine through a crowded downtown. This does not make any sense from a security standpoint at all. I always wondered about it." No matter whether it made sense or not, the president's motorcade route was set, and on November 22, 1963, 2 years, 10 months, and 6 days from when JFK was inaugurated, he was assassinated as his open-top limousine passed by the Texas School Book Depository in downtown Dallas. Evident to anyone then or now, the route chosen was indeed a death trap and raises the question, why did security suddenly become so lax? While that question remains unanswered to this day, Lee Harvey Oswald was arrested shortly after the shooting. Prosecutors alleged he had crouched in a sniper's nest made from book cartons on the 6th floor of the Book Depository building, from which he aimed a Mannlicher Carcano 6.5 millimeter rifle out a top-floor window. Authors note, considerable evidence has surfaced through the years that points toward a 7.65 German Mauser bolt-action rifle being the weapon used to kill Kennedy. Many experts dispute this theory, even though there are primary source accounts that such a gun was found in the Book Depository building. As Kennedy's limousine drove past at precisely 12:30 p.m., according to the police account, Oswald squeezed the trigger 3 times in 6.5 seconds, hitting the president twice and inflicting a fatal head wound. Oswald supposedly fled the building and was captured hours later in a movie theater after allegedly shooting and killing a Dallas police officer, J.D. Tippit. Less than 48 hours later, Oswald himself was fatally shot by Jack Ruby as he was being transferred from police headquarters to the county jail. While Lee Harvey Oswald's motives for shooting John Kennedy and Jack Ruby's for shooting Oswald have been discussed and debated for years, there is little debate regarding Oswald's denial of guilt. At police headquarters after his arrest, the handcuffed Oswald was told he could cover his face with his hands if he wished. To that suggestion, he told reporters, "Why should I hide my face? I haven't done anything to be ashamed of." Later, Oswald stated, "I didn't kill the president. I didn't kill nobody," at a midnight news conference at police headquarters. One eyewitness to Oswald's mentality following his arrest that has never been published comes from Chuck Laser, later to become an investigator in a Michigan sheriff's department. In February 2020, he told this author, "The reason I was in Dallas had to do with a visit with my brother, who I had not seen in a long time and worked in an art gallery there. I walked to the street where President Kennedy passed on the way towards the Texas Book Depository. A short time after he passed, I heard people talking and listening to radios, and it was at that point that I decided to walk to the Dallas City Police Department to see if it was true, not realizing that I would come face to face with Lee Harvey Oswald, where he was between two officers and I had to move out of his way to pass me. I do not believe Oswald shot the president. I walked to the Dallas Police Department right after the shooting, heard on hand radio, and it seems near impossible Oswald could have left the Book Depository, got to the theater, and then to the police department in that short time frame. I came face to face with Oswald in the police department intake and followed him up to another room and left at that point. He appeared confused rather than someone that had just shot someone. I could be wrong, but it did not make sense." District Attorney Henry Wade believed otherwise, telling reporters Oswald's fingerprints had been found on boxes in the depository where the shots were fired and on the murder weapon. Presumably to sew up the case, Wade provided details about a witness who told the authorities that after Oswald boarded a bus following the shooting, he laughed when told that the president had been shot. "There is no question that Oswald was JFK's murderer," Wade boasted. Anyone familiar with the district attorney would have hesitated granting validity to his accusation if they had recalled a dark episode in his career. It was revealed in an article by journalist Mary Mapes entitled "When Henry Wade Executed an Innocent Man," published in the May 2016 issue of D Magazine, a Dallas publication. Mapes wrote, "The legendary DA ran a conviction machine that got results. In 1954, he persuaded a jury to send Tommy Lee Walker to the electric chair just 3 months after his arrest. But a new look at the case reveals one of the greatest injustices in Dallas history." To Mapes's credit, and in the spirit of Dorothy Kilgallen's first-hand reporting based on primary sources, Mapes dug deep into the Walker case while looking for an execution in Texas that could possibly be proven wrongful using DNA. She picked Dallas County since, sadly, it has more exonerations than almost every other county in the nation. As Mapes discovered, Walker's conviction, occurring 10 years before Wade hit the big time by winning a conviction and death sentence for Jack Ruby, was based solely on what appeared to be a coerced confession when Walker admitted killing a young girl named Venice Parker. His alibi seemed solid, 9 witnesses, but because he was black, he became a suspect. K. Captain Will Fritz, who played a major part in the Jack Ruby investigation, had stated in an alarming and racially abusive comment, "We still have about 100 more Negroes to check on." Mapes wrote, "Many hours later, alone, confused, and frightened, Tommy Lee wearily signed a confession for the murder, despite no physical evidence, no real evidence at all linking him to the crime. During the trial, Walker recanted his confession, but it made no difference. An all-white jury convicted him, and he was sentenced to death, mainly, it appears, due to Wade's dogged examination of witnesses and what Mapes called a fiery final argument." Walker was executed on May 12, 1956. Mapes's investigation, including speaking with many witnesses whose accounts destroy any semblance of his guilt, also produced another shocking statement about Jack Ruby's chief prosecutor. "In the years since DNA forensic technology has been improved and utilized to reinvestigate Dallas County criminal cases, at least 25 convictions that Henry Wade oversaw have been overturned, according to the National Registry of Exonerations." In summary, Mapes seems certain Walker was denied justice, that there was blood on Henry Wade's hands for taking the lead in killing an innocent man. When Jack Ruby first learned the news of JFK's shooting, police said he was sitting by the desk of John Newman, a likable advertising salesman for the Dallas Morning News. Ruby, a regular visitor to the newspaper who sought to impress editors and columnists with his inside ideas for stories, discussed the appropriate copy to be included in advertisements for the Carousel and a second nightclub he owned, the Vegas Club. Satisfied with the advertisement, he wrote a check for $1.87 on his merchant's state bank account to pay for the ads. Moments later, at 12:30 or so, a CBS News bulletin blared from a nearby television set. 3 shots were fired at President Kennedy's motorcade today in downtown Dallas. Shortly thereafter, Ruby heard Walter Cronkite, his voice quivering, announce, "President Kennedy died at 1 p.m. Central Standard Time, 2 o'clock Eastern Standard Time, some 38 minutes ago." According to authorities, Jack Ruby then drove to his nightclub, the Carousel. Several hours later, at around midnight, Ruby headed for police headquarters for an anticipated news conference. Packing his nickel-plated .38 pistol, he stood within 10 feet or so of Oswald when Wade presented him to the world. An Associated Press photograph captured Ruby scribbling notes in the back of the room. Questions surfaced later regarding how Ruby ended up in the Dallas Police Department basement where Oswald appeared the next morning, Sunday, November 24th. Ruby told police he drove downtown to send money to one of the strippers who worked for him via the Western Union office and then walked to police headquarters a block away. Left behind in the back seat of his white 1960 Oldsmobile were a red dachshund named Sheba, as well as a set of brass knuckles, a transistor radio, and, noteworthy in view of later developments, a copy of a 2-month-old New York Sunday Mirror article chronicling mobster Joseph Valachi's appearance before Senator John L. McClellan's Senate Select Committee on Improper Activities in Labor and Management in early October. Valachi was the first mafia member to publicly disclose the existence of the underworld organization, coining the phrase Cosa Nostra, our thing, euphemism for the Italian mafia. Ruby's Oldsmobile also contained copies of Dallas and Fort Worth newspapers depicting the intended route of President Kennedy's motorcade. Wearing a dark suit, white shirt, and silk necktie with a gold-plated tie clasp, rather formal attire for a Sunday morning trip to Western Union, Ruby had stuffed into one pocket a roll of bills totaling $2,015.33. He had $60 in traveler's checks as well. In his right front trousers pocket, he carried the loaded pistol. At 11:15 a.m., Dallas homicide detectives escorted a dour-faced Oswald out of Captain Will Fritz's office door. As bright lights showered him, Oswald, at that point the most hated man in the world, smirked at 3 journalists who shouted questions. He was snarly and silent, Beads of perspiration pockmarked his shiny forehead in the stuffy hallway. The police planned to transport Oswald in an armored car to the more secure county jail a few blocks away. That car was stationed in front of a ramp where policeman E.R. Vaughn stood guard. 5 minutes later, a black car driven by Lieutenant Rio Pierce drove up the narrow ramp as Vaughn stepped aside. Ruby later told police that this allowed him to inch his way undetected down the narrow ramp that was 8 to 9 feet wide. This was barely enough to permit a car to enter. As Oswald emerged from an elevator flanked by two detectives, one journalist shouted, "Here he comes!" At this point, WBAP television director Jimmy Turner swore he saw Ruby at the end of the ramp. Oswald was handcuffed to the left wrist of Detective J.R. James Lavelle, who wore a white suit and a gleaming white Stetson hat. Through the years, allegations have been made that the reason why Lavelle chose to wear that day of all days the white suit and the white Stetson, different from any other police official on the scene, was so Ruby, standing on the street adjacent to police headquarters near the Western Union office, could see Lavelle through a window and know when he was leaving his office after interrogating Oswald. This happening, the theory goes, permitted Ruby to then make sure he was in the Dallas Police Department basement at the exact time Oswald was entering with Lavelle at his side. Critics scoff at this allegation, but the detective has never fully explained the reasons why he wore the white suit and Stetson, triggering the belief that he was part of an intended cover-up by aiding Ruby's murder of Oswald. Regardless, Detective Elsie Graves held Oswald's left arm, but there were no officers directly in front of him. Behind Oswald's entourage, several police looked on. Eager to display the alleged killer of JFK and Dallas policeman Tippit to the world, police welcomed the swarm of reporters and photographers gathered for the photo op. Two pivotal newsmen emerged in the ensuing events. Icarus Ike Pappas, one of many journalists who became well known for their reporting of the JFK assassination, and Dan Rather, whose first-rate, fast-breaking accounts of the shooting electrified the world. His sterling performance would culminate in a reporter position with CBS, where he would become the network's longtime primetime news anchor. Pappas, later a noted reporter for CBS, but then working for WNEW in New York, pushed his way to a spot nearly kiss close to the most infamous man in the world. Intent on gaining a noteworthy quote from Oswald, despite the presence of more than 70 reporters and 100 police officers, Pappas shoved his microphone near the accused killer. Oswald sneered as flashbulbs popped and floodlights glared in the background. At exactly 11:21 a.m., Pappas asked a question just as Jack Ruby angled in toward Oswald. The prisoner's bruised, unshaven face reflected his struggle with police when he was arrested. Television cameramen focused on the scene as millions of viewers glimpsed the face of the accused. They heard Pappas ask, "Lee, do you have anything to say in your defense?" It was a question Oswald never answered. A second later, Ruby, wearing a nap-brimmed gray fedora, edged closer to Oswald. As Ruby approached, Oswald's face seemed to register a glimmer of recognition. Conspiracy buffs later alleged that Oswald recognized Ruby. Others maintained that Oswald's expression was an acknowledgement of Ruby's pistol. Raising the weapon, Ruby extended his right arm, thrust the gun toward Oswald's stomach, and, from a distance of about 15 inches, pulled the trigger. At the sound of the gunshot, Detective Lavelle, his eyes reflecting disbelief, recoiled in horror. Robert Jackson's Pulitzer Prize-winning photograph was taken at this moment. Oswald moaned in anguish, and as his eyes looked upward, he crumpled to the ground. As the television image of the assassination spread across the planet, the black-and-white footage featured KRLD-TV reporter Bob Huffaker's commentary. "He's been shot! He's been shot! Lee Oswald has been shot by a man with a gun! There's absolute panic here in the basement of Dallas Police Headquarters. Detectives have their guns drawn. Oswald has been shot. No question, he has been shot." Detective Graves freed his hand from Oswald's arm, grabbed the burly shooter, and wrestled him to the ground like a defensive lineman tackling a fullback. Graves grasped the revolver so Ruby could fire no more. By then, Oswald was in cardiac arrest, with wounds to his kidneys, spleen, and aorta. The main suspect in the assassination of President John Fitzgerald Kennedy died a short time later at Parkland Memorial Hospital. Al Maddox handcuffed, booked, and escorted Ruby into jail. Maddox, a deputy sheriff for only 7 months, told this author, "I knew Jack. When I first saw him in jail, he was barefoot and crying. He said, 'I didn't kill that man.' I said, 'Jack, we were all watching television and saw it.'" Over 2 days in November 1963, three men, the President of the United States, Dallas policeman J.D. Tippit, and Lee Harvey Oswald, had been murdered. One man, Jack Ruby, was left to stand in judgment regarding his responsibility for the assassination of the president's alleged assassin. When closely examined, the events surrounding Ruby's trial, and the trial itself, should have been an eye-opener for anyone truly interested in the truth about the Dallas killings. But the true meaning of these events did not open eyes until 2018, when this author's book, The Reporter Who Knew Too Much, was published, providing the necessary details to connect the dots concerning Ruby's extensive involvement in the events before, during, and after the assassination of JFK. Although, as will become clear, Dorothy Kilgallen challenged any semblance of the Oswald alone theory before any other reporter did so, beginning with a series of scathing articles first under the banner, "The Oswald Alone File Must Not Close," within 6 days of the assassination. The dots were, for certain, connected by her in a column she wrote in the Journal American on April 14, 1965, after the Ruby trial had ended. It was entitled, "Why Did Oswald Risk All by Shooting Cop?" It is difficult to believe no one paid attention, since the column appeared to ask a very logical question. Kilgallen wrote, "A mysterious and significant aspect of the events following the assassination of President Kennedy in Dallas has never been explored publicly, although it must have occurred to crack reporters covering the case as well as authorities investigating the tragedies. The important question, why did Lee Harvey Oswald, presumably fleeing from the police after the assassination, approach Patrolman J.D. Tippit's car in broad daylight with witnesses standing by, and shoot the policeman 3 times, although he had not said a word to Oswald? Oswald had managed to slip away from the scene and was, up to that point, not a reckless one. A man who knows he is wanted by the authorities after a spectacular crime does not seek out a policeman, usually, unless he has decided to give himself up, and certainly Oswald was not doing that. By shooting Tippit, instead of trying to make himself inconspicuous, Oswald put himself in double jeopardy. His act almost guaranteed his arrest. Why? A whodunit fan would infer that the policeman knew something about Oswald that was so dangerous the policeman had to be silenced at any cost, even Oswald's chance at escape and freedom. Important to remember when evaluating this type of inside information, Kilgallen, unlike any other reporter at the time, possessed credible facts from credible sources only a reporter with her clout had access to, and which became the basis for the numerous columns she wrote. Dorothy Kilgallen had become obsessed with the JFK assassination due to her longtime friendship with the president. Recall that she had attended, as a special guest, his inauguration and was captivated, as was the rest of the world, when the 35th President of the United States spoke the famous words, "Ask not what your country can do for you, ask what you can do for your country." For 18 months after JFK died, the determined reporter devoted her life to uncovering the truth about who killed the president and why. For Kilgallen, the crusade was more than business. It was personal, since she and JFK had become close friends, especially after Kilgallen arranged, through her friendship with Presidential Press Secretary Pierre Salinger, a visit to the White House with Kilgallen's youngest son, Kerry. When the 8-year-old redhead and his mother arrived, Salinger conducted the tour himself. While in the cabinet room, President Kennedy suddenly appeared. He invited Dorothy and Kerry into the Oval Office. While they sat and chatted, JFK looked at a bundle of letters Kerry had brought, written to the president by the boy's third-grade classmates. JFK gifted Kerry a number of presidential souvenirs, including a ballpoint pen inscribed with the presidential seal and a gold pin in the shape of PT-109 that the president placed on the youngster's striped school tie. After reading Kerry's letter, JFK said, "That's very well written, very well done." Kilgallen's friend Marlon Swing confirmed Kilgallen had a special friendship with John Kennedy, who was dear to her heart. The CBS producer recalled the night he and Kilgallen returned from a Broadway opening and were sitting in her office. "The phone rang," Swing said, "and it was very late, 1:30, almost in the morning. It was Ted Sorensen, special counsel to the president. No small potatoes. They were talking, and I heard Dorothy say, 'Oh, really, say hello to him, too.'" Jack Kennedy had walked into the room, asked who Sorensen was talking to, and when he learned it was Dorothy, said, "Say hi for me." Bob Bach, Kilgallen's friend and What's My Line producer, noted another time when JFK and Kilgallen met, and the details he added indicate more than a passing friendship. "At the Stork Club," Bach stated, "I watched with a mischievous thrill as Jack Kennedy, a young senator out late with someone other than his wife, touched base with Dorothy. 'Hello, Dorothy,' he said. 'Do you remember the night we played charades at your house? What fun it was!'" After the assassination, Kilgallen wept with Kerry in her arms for a man they both loved. She then wrote in her Journal American column, "The picture that stays in my mind was the one of this tall young man bending over a small boy, carefully scrutinizing envelopes until he came to the name Kerry Arden Colmer, grade 3B. This was the man who was assassinated in Dallas." This was the same man whose small boy, John John, as well as daughter Caroline, no longer had a father who could romp around with them in the Oval Office, part of the tragedy so often overlooked. At the exact time Oswald was dying in Dallas, famed San Francisco attorney Melvin Belli had enjoyed lunch with friend J. Kelly Farris at Scoma's restaurant at Fisherman's Wharf. Belli was a bigger-than-life character who San Francisco attorney Federico Serre told the Chicago Tribune was like a big howitzer. You had to point him in the right direction. Over the span of 60 years of practicing law, Belli represented famous personalities such as actors Errol Flynn, Lana Turner, and Mae West, and boxers George Foreman and Muhammad Ali. Other clients included the Rolling Stones, comedian Lenny Bruce, and mobster Mickey Cohen. As Belli spoke with Farris, a friendly waiter walked by and told Belli that a man named Jack Ruby had killed Oswald. Farris told this author that Belli, called by Life magazine the King of Torts for his prowess as a personal injury attorney, boasted, "Well, since Oswald's dead, I'll have to defend Ruby." Perplexed by the comment, Farris asked Belli to elaborate. He did not do so. Certain the killing of Oswald confounded logic, Kilgallen began to investigate the man she had learned was Ruby. She wondered why he was present in the Dallas Police Department basement garage for Oswald's transfer. Within minutes, she reached out to reliable sources in the department looking for answers.